Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program. Tonight, we're talking about trauma. We have two guests joining us tonight, Abby. We have Megan Ross, who's the Director of Program Development and Trauma Awareness at Timberline Knolls, which is a residential treatment center in Illinois that helps women struggling with addiction, eating disorders, trauma, and post-traumatic stress disorder. In the studio, we have Gail Jaffe, the Manager of Community Engagement at the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center, which provides a range of free and confidential services to sexual assault survivors and their significant others, and collaborates with diverse communities and organizations around responding to and preventing sexual violence.
I want to welcome both of you. Megan?
Thank you so much.
Hi, Megan. So I've actually seen you speak, and we were very impressed, which is how we just thought you really laid out the description of trauma beautifully. And Gail, welcome.
Thank you.
So what I wanted to tell our listeners is, what is trauma? Like, what is a traumatic event and how does it affect people? I know that's a big question, but I just kind of want to introduce people. Do you want to start, Megan?
Absolutely. One of the really interesting things about trauma itself is that though we could list an entirety of experiences, it's truly how somebody experiences a moment and handles it after the moment, regardless of what the moment is. So to qualify a traumatic event being war and conflict or the loss of a house or perhaps the passing of a, you know, furry friend, be it a dog or a cat, or you know, the loss of a job. It could be anywhere on the spectrum. And I think that that's one of the most interesting things about trauma is that it is not for outsiders to decide, but it is for those that experience the aftermath of an experience to notice if it's affecting their life post.
That I like that. It's kind of in the eye of the beholder. I mean, it's the person who's experienced it.
Correct.
And so what happens to people when they experience something they feel as traumatic?
Oftentimes what ends up happening is that there is a challenge with the tolerance of the present moment after a traumatic moment has occurred. So say that somebody is in a car accident, then their stress response is riddled with the car accident, and that riddled stress response moves into the new present moment for them. And it's challenging to differentiate what has happened, what might happen, and what is happening. And so if we're talking about substance, oftentimes what we do is that we turn towards something else to replace the sensation or the thoughts that we cannot handle or tolerate right now.
Yeah, and I mean, we come from a substance abuse treatment program, and the assumption we work with is that a good percentage of the people we work with have been through something that they considered traumatic, and they have a trauma history, which is the, you know, the kind of more jargony term, and that they have are using substances not necessarily to avoid dealing with it, but they haven't dealt with it if they're using substances.
Correct.
Gail, at the Rape Crisis Center, are you handling the people that come in to see you under the assumption that there's a great range of symptoms of trauma and some of them might not even be having been through a horrible episode like rape, some of them might not be experiencing the complete trauma symptoms yet? Is there a way that you prepare them or treat them so they can be prepared when that stuff starts to happen?
Sure, that's a great question. So we see a range of people who come through our doors for services or who we interface with on the hotline or in an emergency room. And there's a real range and sort of this depth and breadth to the kinds of experience that they've had in relation to what it is that they've encountered. And so we come to the work from an empowerment perspective and really work with clients. We do a full evaluation generally in our office, or if we're on the hotline or in an emergency room, a briefer assessment of where people are, and really stay with where they are. So we don't try and name their experience unless they're naming it. And we don't try to qualify it and or compare it and really discourage that from happening, so that we don't come into it, defining something as being worse than something else, or, you know, easier to deal with than maybe a different kind of situation. And what we will do oftentimes is, you know, if it's somebody who, say, has experienced a recent sexual assault, which really is an umbrella term for a number of different both physical and non-physical things that can happen, we'll talk about what they're experiencing in the moment, maybe some of the things to experience if this is either an assault that recently happened, or say memories of a previous assault or abuse that have come to the surface, and work through it with them in that way, so that there's really a shared understanding and it's an evolving process.
Megan, Gail was just talking about kind of point of impact processing a little bit, and we also know that people experience delayed trauma or reactions to trauma. And is there different ways that treating happens, or different clinical responses to different types of trauma?
I'm always really excited when I hear people describe services the way that Gail just described, because it's really empowering, actually, as you use that word in your own description. But it's really exciting because that type of an approach to trauma works no matter where and when and how and what the trauma actually occurred. If it was, an adverse childhood experience that got compounded through family systems, if it was a recent acute assault, it's fantastic to really truly embody the practice of meeting somebody where they are at and allowing the present moment to guide the situation and the treatment, versus trying to pull out or carve out, or historically in psychotherapy, to go deep, go hard, and leave no prisoners around, like, exploding into the story of the trauma, but really being able to be present with what is the tolerance level, what is the resilience capacity, and what is the empowerment that's emerging through the process. So exactly what was described is beneficial at all ranges.
Well, it's really interesting because I've been a clinician for 30 years now. And, there's this whole idea of, there've been a lot of, trauma-related things that have come up. There was like the idea of people planting false memories in people and the idea that, that a lot of the people were making this up, and it's been really hard to watch. And so, but I mean, and I feel like with Judith Herman kind of equating it with PTSD is PTSD. And if it's because had something happen to you as a kid, or it's because you were in war, the responses look kind of the same. And I think that was kind of a wonderful way to do things. But if somebody calls, we'll start first with Gail. If somebody calls and says, "I think something happened," what do you do?
That's also a really good question. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we talk with our hotline counselors quite a bit through our extensive training program. And it really, again, has to go back to not defining an experience for someone, for a survivor, but really starting again with what that person is coming to you with and what that person is sharing. And so letting their particular story unfold in the way that they feel comfortable telling it, sharing as many or as little details as they would like to, offering support and, you know, when appropriate, talking about services or other things that might be helpful. And during that process, talking about, you know, support systems, ways that they're coping, safety assessment, other things along those lines.
So you're letting them lead the way, and like
Absolutely.
Megan said, meet them where they're at. Megan, I was wondering, when you were talking about doing intakes with people, does everybody who come in know that they're suffering from trauma or traumatic stress disorder?
Not at Timberline Knolls, no. And, you know, earlier someone was saying that they ended up noticing how the high percentage of people with trauma. And on one hand, the human experience is fraught with really large challenges of life. So at Timberline Knolls, that ends up looking like about 90%+ of our resident population has a trauma history. Now, what they may come in with may be either shadowing or replacing or dumbing down that experience or closing that experience. And so through the process of recovery in a variety of areas, sometimes the trauma then illuminates.
So you use some terms there. What does trauma look like? You work with a female population. What kind of manifestations are there, behaviors, symptoms that show up that you guys see regularly?
At Timberline Knolls, a lot of what we see is the process of isolation, eating disorders, substance use and abuse, self-harm, drawing away from others, be it family, friends, school. So a disruption in the regular cycle of life.
Why? What do they benefit when they do that? There's got to be a benefit in that. What does it do for them?
That process is generally an experience of replacing an identity in the present moment with the identity of the trauma. And I'll explain that. So oftentimes those who have experienced trauma to the point that it affects their life, right, which is what trauma is that it's affecting your present moment. And to that point, oftentimes there's an identifying factor with the trauma versus an identifying factor with self. And so what all of those behaviors give that person is that they reinforce their perception of their own identity being their trauma. Now, that can be implicit or explicit, meaning that they're aware of that or they're not aware of that.
So I mean, what happens is somebody has something happen to them, and it's a huge thing for them. And I would guess that, Gail, you would have somebody who's fairly recently happened, right? Most people call you, it's a fairly recent thing. It's a rape crisis hotline. So what do you recommend that people do, and what kinds of things do you see them kind of experiencing?
We do hear from quite a few people who have experienced recent assaults, and I know that that's something that one would assume with a hotline. We also hear from a wide variety of people who have experienced, you know, histories of, say, sexual abuse or assaults that have been, you know, many years ago, if not decades ago as well. But with people who have experienced recent assaults, like we were talking before, sometimes people will call and they'll say, you know, I know something happened to me. I'm not sure what. Or, you know, they will actually call and they'll say, you know, I know that I was assaulted, and I'm not sure what to do, or I think I was, my memory is a little bit fuzzy, and so, you know, I'm trying to make some decisions here and figure out what to do next. And so, you know, we'll follow their lead, and really try to provide the best kind of information and options and resources that we can come up with. Well, so we'll give them information. Let's say that they are talking about, you know, maybe having experienced injuries, something along those lines. We'll talk to them and provide some information about options as to how they might get checked out medically, and just to make sure that they're okay. We'll talk to them about safety concerns, both physical safety and emotional safety as well. If, say, they're considering doing an evidence collection kit or reporting to police, we'll talk with them about some of their options there, really putting the information out in a way that allows them to make the decision that's best for them, and really framing it that way, even if they're asking us what our opinion is about what they should do.
That must be really hard, because I would guess a lot of people don't want to pursue it and are scared to pursue it.
Absolutely. It's very challenging. I think that for a number of reasons, people have different levels of trust and faith in reporting to law enforcement authorities or, you know, say, campus safety officials if they're on a campus.
Yeah, we've been seeing a lot of that in the news.
Sure. It's been very prevalent.
I'm wondering, Megan, is there like a triage or, you know, I know that in the armed forces now they're offering like battlefield help to kind of help the warriors to process traumatic events there. Is there a benefit to address trauma at the point of impact, or is it best to kind of let the client lead the way there? Because from our experience in our clinic, a lot of times, people want to defer that. That's the last thing they want to deal with. And the last thing they want to talk about. So is there a benefit from addressing it early on?
I think that there can be a benefit if the system, and when I say system, I mean the nervous system of the individual, is ready and has the availability to do that. Sometimes addressing trauma really closely to its impact just dysregulates the system even further. Mm-hmm. Now, if there is resilience already built within that individual and they can tolerate it, and the way that you know that they can tolerate it is that you have the ability to track their present moment awareness. So what do they notice now, and how do they notice what they notice now? If you're able to do that, then you can actually assess if their system is available to that type of an intervention.
So I mean, what I'm hearing from both of you is that people have traumatic events happen. How they experience it is really depends on who they are. And I love the word resilience, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But then good clinicians are going to, and good treaters and good supporters of these people need to follow their lead, but with a little bit of information about, because I've known a lot of people over the years, they want to hide it. And so I see that they need a little more information provided, and a little, you know, you may be experiencing this, or you may be withdrawing, or you may be isolating, or you may be doing this, to give them the opportunity to push it a little further. But what you're
and
really,
create an environment where they feel comfortable doing that
and safe. And what shouldn't be happening is where people go in and, you know, kind of feel like they should talk about all the details.
Right,
of the,
let it out. Because it can feel like a floodgate opening up that doesn't feel safe.
So people who, if they're in need of help, shouldn't be afraid that they're going to have to go in high in the first day and tell everybody this horrible thing
that's
happened.
That's right. We're talking about trauma tonight on Right Turn Radio with Megan Ross from Timberline Knowles and Gail Jaffe from the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center. We have a caller. Joe, welcome to Right Turn Radio. What's going on tonight?
Hello.
Hello, Joe.
Yes.
Hi, Joe.
I'm suffering from. I just had my pet put to sleep.
Oh, I'm sorry. What happened?
A couple of weeks ago, I raised him since he was 6 weeks old. I'm a substance abuser too, and I sniff heroin.
Wow, you sound terrible. So, how old was your pet, and what was it?
I
Joe, we want you to...
We actually will talk to you offline.
Yeah. We want the...
Okay. Ed's going to get your number.
And we want you to reach out and get some help. We want anybody to know suffering from substance abuse or trauma that there is help out there. We're going to give you some information at the end of the show.
So, you know, I mean, we were talking about life being difficult, and I think that was just an example of, you know, you never know what's going to be the thing that is too hard to handle. So, you know, when does trauma become difficult? And I'm going to start with Megan. When is trauma a problem and more than just life being difficult?
When it affects the functionality of any part of your life.
Like what?
And, you know, Joe calling in is a wonderful and heart-wrenching example of how loss can impact someone's history and how their history then all of a sudden crashes right into their present moment. And it's that crash that ends up creating almost like an apex moment of being able to handle it or not being able to handle it. And not handle it in the way of, okay, I can shut down and manage, but being able to be open to the struggling process, knowing that it's going to conclude.
You mean being willing to look at it and walk through it a little?
Absolutely.
You know, there's one way that the clinicians and the community handles it, and then there's family and loved ones and friends. And we were talking before the show about this, about the idea that so many people, trauma can manifest itself in so many different ways and behaviors. And some, you know, the common refrain is, well, it's been 2 months, 2 years, 2 decades. You should be over it by now. Gail, I'm just wondering, the community that you work with and the population that you work with, have they communicated that they go through that with friends and family?
Absolutely. And it can be very difficult for people, as I'm sure you can imagine, who have experienced a traumatic event, whether it's been very recently, maybe a certain amount of years ago, maybe decades ago, to have someone who they trust enough to disclose something about what happened to them and to trust that that person will respond in some way that's supportive, and then at a certain point to get the feedback from that person or from people that this is something that, you know, there's been enough time that's gone by that the person who experienced this trauma should somehow be over it. And it can end up being even more shaming than the level of shame that a lot of trauma survivors feel. It can be very isolating, and it can really get in the way of their deciding to tell anybody else or seek services. It can really undermine the recovery and healing process for people.
And it also can have profound impacts on interpersonal relationships and all that. I just wanted to read off a stat that 8% of Americans at some time in their lives experience post-traumatic stress disorder. That's not a small micro problem.
And the post-traumatic stress disorder is the non-successful working through of a trauma.
Right.
So all this is happening, and I guess, Megan, it would be really nice if you could explain why it becomes like a cycle and what's going on in the brain in post-traumatic stress disorder. Someone's been traumatized. They have, for some reason, been unable to work through it, and they're experiencing a lot of symptoms. So what is going on in the brain that's causing all this?
Sure. Oftentimes, and this is for trauma, the full spectrum of trauma, not just post-traumatic stress disorder, but for the full spectrum of trauma, oftentimes the stress response, imagine a hill, and up at the very top of the hill, you have what we know as fight, flight, and freeze. And so for those who have experienced any type of acute trauma, they move up the hill and then usually hang out at the top. And they never quite come back down the hill, which would be a resolution of a stress discharge. It would be the system kind of re-regulating itself. So they're moving up the hill, hanging out at the top of the hill. And that repetition of just moving up the stress response, and then that stress response becoming smaller and smaller, and the propensity for it to move up into flooding or dysregulated areas just grows. And so as somebody has either experienced one event and they move up that stress response, that kind of gets wired into their system. And there's this lovely term called Hebb's axiom, which means what wires together fires together. So therefore, neurologically, somebody is experiencing something one time, it's easier to experience it two times.
So I can
three times.
Right. And I can have a childhood trauma, let's say, and I can be in a room with 20 other people and a plate will drop to the floor and everybody will turn and look at the plate and I'll have gone into the fight or flight response.
Correct. Exactly. And so then as life goes on, any type of event starts doing that to your system. And so it becomes easier for that to increase. One of the areas, you know, people look at ACEs, which is adverse childhood experiences, and how many of those have you had for your just neurological system to shift and to respond to a plate falling or a door slamming in more of a jumping, acute, paranoia, looking around the room sort of way where most of the other people in the room are going, oh, wow, the wind really blew that door shut loudly.
Well, so people are constantly in this state of arousal. They're constantly feeling, easily triggered into this fight or flight. And so what does that do to somebody after a while? I mean,
for one, it's exhausting because you can imagine the amount of adrenaline that gets dumped into a system repeatedly. And to have that experience is quite tiring. And then there's also just sort of a fear factor that gets built within somebody's system, fearful that it might happen again. And so they begin to remove themselves from maybe events or extracurricular activities that they enjoyed, people that at one time brought some kind of community to them. And they begin to pull back from those types of experiences in fear that that's going to happen again, because more likely than not, it will.
Right. The wind might blow again or something might happen again.
The wind is always blowing.
Yeah. The answer, my friend.
Well, this is, this is pointing, I mean, there's such a cluster of symptoms and, you know, like there's personality disorders attached to some of this stuff and mood disorders and all that. And so what I'm interested as we move forward after the break is learning how you treat this stuff. And I know there's not one blanket of treatment that works for everybody, but we're going to talk to Megan and Gail when we come back and talk about the help that's available out there, how family members can help and kind of help parse out the treatment, the treatment availability. And we're going to find out what people can do and if, you know, how it's treated. We'll be back right after the break. About trauma with Megan Ross from Timberline Knowles and Gail Jaffe from the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center.
And we wanted to know, I mean, we know a lot of people get better, and we're going to start with you, Gail. What kind of treatment do you recommend? You know, do you get to see people get better? Do you hear about it?
We absolutely get a chance to see people get better. And that's one thing that I really wanted to stress to your listeners is that there's hope available, there's help available, and people absolutely can get better and can heal. And so there are all of these different approaches to trauma treatment that are out there depending on the types of services that people seek. We provide individual counseling and group counseling where we are, but there are certainly a number of intensive trauma treatment programs in the area, and they take different approaches.
And family members, do you work with them, or are there special services for them also?
We do. We see quite a number of, so we consider them significant others, and they can be partners, family members, friends, and we work with them just as closely as we do with survivors. Sometimes they'll come in together, and sometimes the significant others will come in separately or call our hotline separately to get their own support so that they get what they need. And then they can feel more equipped to support the people that they care about who have been impacted.
That sounds great. So Megan, what do you provide, and do you include family members or loved ones?
We do include family members and loved ones. And at Timberline Knolls, being a residential treatment facility, family is encouraged to visit as well as be a part of our family therapy sessions that are weekly. And just to add on to everything that Gail said, we also offer sensory and somatic integrated modalities.
What's that
and
mean?
The
what
reason
does that
we
mean?
Do that is for everything that was described before, where someone may not have the awareness of the impact or of the trauma itself, and so to become aware of their sensations of the present moment allows them to then be able to differentiate what perhaps they've been experienced trauma-wise and perhaps who they are or are becoming in the present moment or in reality. And those look like expressive therapies being art, dance movement therapy, yoga therapy, equine, so that you can have the relational aspect rebuilt, being that a lot of trauma ends up affecting interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
And then also looking at other modalities like somatic experiencing, sensory motor, and just the first phases of EMDR.
And by EMDR, you're referring to eye movement?
Correct. Eye movement.
Something. Desensitization.
Regulation.
EMDR
process
is definitely something that we look at on our campus as where is the readiness of the individual.
Right.
And we mentioned that before in regards to those either returning or about to return from combat, and just really where is the readiness of the system,
right?
Meaning that you're constantly having to embody yourself as a clinician to be with those that are struggling so that you can guide them through the process of being in the present moment healthfully.
Do you guys do cue exposure therapy there?
We do not do exposure therapy, and there are a number of reasons why we don't. One is just the acuity level, so how intense are the behaviors?
Right.
And exposure therapy for our population generally doesn't match the readiness of the individual.
It's, right. People are inpatient, so they're probably they're fairly fragile or fairly early on in the recovery process.
Let's say you're a family member and you see your daughter doing self-harm behavior as an adolescent. Would that be something where, you know, they should call you guys or should get some help? Does it always mean that that person has experienced trauma?
It doesn't always mean it, and yet often it does. And really the capacity to be with and listen are profound and needed. They are just the foundational interventions for anything that you end up seeing. Can you observe it? Can you listen?
So when should people contact you, Gail? I mean, when should they feel comfortable contacting the Rape Crisis Center?
Significant others?
Anybody.
Mean, or
anybody.
Anybody. At any point, really. You know, we talk to people who call and are very clear about what it is that they're looking for. And at, you know, the other end of the spectrum, we talk to people who aren't quite sure what it is that they're looking for, whether they're a survivor or a significant other, where, you know, they're calling for someone to listen to them in a non-judgmental, supportive way and to help support them in parsing out what it is that that's going to be right for them in terms of what they're needing.
And how do they get in touch with you?
They can call our 24/7 hotline. It is, I know this is going to be posted as well,
yes,
but it's 1-800-841-8371. And I know that you have listeners who are outside of what's technically our service area in the Boston area. Anybody can call us, though, and our hotline counselors have access to identifying resources that will be within your area and coverage zone.
Megan, how can folks get in touch with you at Timberline Knowles?
At Timberline Knowles, they can end up reaching out to us online at timberlineknowles.com, as well as calling to speak with a licensed therapist at 855-263-6261. And similarly to Gail, it's a phone call at any moment throughout.
That's great.
Your curiosity or question.
That's wonderful.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Megan Ross, for joining us on the phone from Timberline Knowles.
My absolute pleasure.
Thanks for the good work you do. And Gail Jaffe from the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center. Gail, it was great to have you in the studio, and thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you.
So this is another one of those shows where we start and we're like, let's talk about trauma. And then I always think at the end of the show, we need 10 more shows.
That's
on
right.
This.
Well, I mean, I think we really got in touch with, you know, that it affects different people different ways. And there's a lot of treatment out there. There's a lot of hope.
There's a lot of hope and people like Gail's organization. It's wonderful that those things exist. We are on iTunes, Abby. We have a podcast.
Hey, you guys should all listen to any of the shows, or if you hear a show or look at a show and you say, my friend so-and-so should listen to this, you can actually tell them about it.
It's called Right Turn Radio on iTunes. If you have ideas for shows for us, get in touch with us through our Facebook page, Right Turn, and support us. Check us out online at right-turn.org. Come and enjoy the Boston's best sober cafe at Right Turn
That's
Live
right.
every Saturday night at 299 Broadway in Arlington. You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.